time for another episode of Stick a Fork in It. How long have we been doing this? 4 years now?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, it feels longer.
Yeah. Yeah, we've been doing this for 4 years. We're one of the only nonprofits out there that have a little podcast about our work, what we do, who we know, who we meet. And I'm really excited because we have a new team member that I am learning so much from and being introduced to so many amazing people. Lorena, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, everyone. Thank you, Shannon.
Absolutely. And you, I'm really excited because I did a little bit of my homework. You're bringing an amazing woman. It's Women's History Month. And you and I were sitting and talking about who should we bring on to talk about women's history, someone who's impacted our community directly. And take it away, Lorena. Please introduce our guest.
Absolutely. So I have the privilege of knowing our former Senator Janet Cruz for many, many years. Prior to the start of the podcast, we were just talking about my daughter and how she's, you know, seen her grow up. But I had the amazing fortune of getting paired up with Janet back when I was a very young individual coming into the city of Tampa, doing my work, getting into this government relations work. And through the New Leaders Council, Janet was my mentor. And I remember our first lunch together, just having conversations and learning so much about her. She literally is just one of these founding members of the Tampa community. She is a force to be reckoned with, whether it's championing issues that are impacting our schools, issues that are impacting our children. In the health sphere, she has, you know, been a vocal voice as well. And in my previous roles, prior to coming Feeding Tampa Bay, she has always been someone that I've been able to lean on the legislative side whenever we've had questions and or projects coming up through my professional career. So I am just super happy to have Janet here with us. Like you said, you know, celebrating Women's History Month, and nothing better than a strong woman who has faced a lot in her career and in her life. And I just can't wait to have all of you learn a little bit more about her.
Well, welcome, 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 Miss Janet. We had a few moments to talk before we hit the record button, and I'm just so excited to get to know you better. You know, you mentioned, and actually we kind of did our homework a little bit, you were born right here in Tampa Bay. You were born in Tampa, actually.
I was born in Ybor City.
Oh, well, there you go. Tell us a little bit about that. There's not a lot of folks that are born and raised here that come from our generation.
Well, that's true. And I am the great, great granddaughter of cigar factory workers who were immigrants that came to this country back when they welcomed immigrants to work in, you know, manual labor jobs. And back then, the cigar factories were not automated. So hundreds of people sat at tables and rolled cigars by hand. And my grandparents and great grandparents all did that. And my grandmother, until probably in almost into her 90s, she was still doing some of that work. And it's all they knew. I remember hugging my grandparents and great grandparents, and they all smelled like not a burnt cigar, but they smelled like tobacco before it was burned. Right. You know, their hair smelled like it. It was wonderful. Right. Yeah. Cigars were something that we celebrated in our homes because it was indeed their livelihood. Then some brilliant inventor figured out how to automate cigar rolling, and their jobs kind of went away. But by then, my great-grandparents were getting ready to retire, and there were a few little factories that my grandparents worked in. And there were a few factories left in Tampa, but you saw the factories die off after automation. And they moved a lot of it over to the islands because the labor was cheaper. But if it weren't for cigar factories in Ybor City, we would just be another little redneck town dot on the map. But the Sicilians and the Cubans and the Spaniards, there were Germans too. They brought, and then the Jewish families were many of the merchants on 7th Avenue, and they you know, they all commingled recipes. I mean, my father's Sicilian, my mom's family were Spaniards and Cubans, and, you know, they could make each other's recipes, and it was pretty exciting. So it was a wonderful place, and the heritage and the pride of the families that worked there and worked many, many hours in that factory, never complained, never took a dime. If they couldn't afford it, they didn't buy it. And, you know, they built strong families. You know, they built kids like me who were able to be not just intellectual or well-educated, or they were kids of true grit. You know, it was really, it's wonderful to see the successes of many of the kids whose family started right there on 7th Avenue in Ybor City. It's a great story.
Could you name a few? Are there some folks would recognize names?
Here's one of my favorites. Those of us who've been in Tampa for a while will recognize the old, there was a grocery store called Cash and Carry. Well, yeah. Cash and Carry was really started as a vegetable, a produce stand in produce kind of grocery in Ybor City by the Greco family. They were Italians. The Italians did a lot of there were a lot of merchants. There was Agliano and Sons who did the fish market. There was Cacciatore and Cacciatore Brothers that were the butchers. Mm-hmm. So my great-grandparents and grandparents would walk down Ybor and get their meats here and their produce here and their fish here. There were lots of little markets that were all specialized. So the Greco family came from there. They started the Cash and Carry grocery chain. Let me think about some others. There are so many names that I can tell you about. I have to just think about them. But the Greco family is the one that I remember so well. But, yep. The Italians were, some of them, you know, they were the Cuban cigar factory owners, and the Spaniards were a little afraid of the Sicilians. So they, I think they kind of tried to keep them out of management. So the Italians were like, okay, we'll show you. They went and became the merchants of 7th Avenue, and they ended up the wealthiest of the bunch of immigrants. So it's funny how things happen. These are stories that are passed down from great grandparents and talking about it all, but sometimes that's how it all begins.
Well, yeah, and what a culturally rich environment to grow up in and be introduced to and learn things from. You know, my grandmother came from North Carolina, but she came here so young that she learned wonderful Cuban dishes and Italian dishes and all of these wonderful things from her neighbors in South Tampa that she passed them on to her own family.
Well, my father spoke fluent Sicilian in his home. But he spoke fluent Spanish from hanging out with the kids in the streets. My father could converse in three languages because of his friends. And that's basically what was happening there. It was really great. And there's a really interesting study about the immigrants that came from some of those small towns in Sicily. Remember, it was a tough time at the turn of the century. There was no work. So they were coming here. And that group of immigrants that came over, I guess, maybe 10 or 20 years, they left Sicily. Many of them never went back. And they have come to Tampa to study the Sicilian language as it is here because it's kind of frozen in time. It evolved in Sicily to be more Italian. So the dialect that they, the Sicilians, and I don't know how many are left nowadays that speak it fluently, but my dad's family did. One of the purest forms of the language. So it's really interesting, the history. I found that quite fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. Ybor City was a beautiful place. You can look at history. I know it has a few things that bubble up here and there, but really the crux of it all is going into the buildings and the businesses who have been there for a long time, and the restaurants is a really great place to visit even now. So tell us, what was it like as a girl and a teen for you growing up during that time?
Well, you know, as a young kid, it was pretty idyllic. There was Mr. Miranda who went around on his little, it was a bike at one point. And then I think it might've been, I think it was still a bike, but he would sell his hot homemade devil crabs right out of the cooler on his bike. And you'd stop them in the street and they were probably 15 or 20 cents. I don't know, but it was the highlight of the day. My mom would go every Saturday down to 7th Avenue and pick up her meats and her cheeses and everything. So it was a, you know, it was a stroll down Ybor and it was really very lovely. And that was probably in the 60s. Then I went to the junior college there in the 70s. And because of the decline in the factories, you know, people were basically moving out of Ybor City. There was this horrible thing that happened. I think it was the late 60s, but they called it urban renewal. They were buying houses in Ybor. They were transplanting some families, you know, out Palm River Way in some new subdivisions. But it just essentially between the interstate, the loss of cigar factories, the interstate loss of cigar factories, Ybor just was on a steady decline. And in the 70s, when I went to school there in the Ybor campus, 7th Avenue had tumbleweeds rolling down the street. There was nothing there. Almost every building was shuttered. There were some artists that were living in lofts or making, you know, artist lofts. And there were some kids that would hang out there. But it was really in a sad state. It was in a sad state. There wasn't much there. I mean, Columbia survived, but there wasn't much there.
Wow. So where did you go to high school? Tell us about your high school years. Maybe was there a mentor, you know, that is there somebody that influenced you during that time?
Well, I, you know, my parents were divorced. Like I said, I had this beautiful life and then my parents divorced. It really changed everything, you know, where I had only known happiness. I saw, you know, like a very sad mom who'd been home with us every day, dropped us off at school, picked us up. Now she had to go to work. She moved us to South Agandy because she took a position, with a gypsum plant, in Port Tampa. So it was, you know, out of Ybor, out of West Tampa, south of Agandy, and, spent time with my dad in West Tampa, but, the time with my mom was south of Agandy. So, I went to Ballast Point, Monroe and Robinson High School and, had a wonderful time, but we were kids on our own. My mom had to be at work at 7:30 in the morning. So it was my brother a year older, my sister 2 years younger than me. I was the middle kid. And, you know, we would get up in the morning, get ourselves dressed and walk almost 2 miles to Ballast Point Elementary School. I mean, it sounds outlandish today, but that's what we did. I mean, my mom had no one else to count on, and that's what we did. In the summertime, there were no summer camps for us. I had a girlfriend that lived across the street. Her name was Tootsie. She was a couple years older than me, but we would get the lawnmower out in the summertime and go knock on doors, us two girls, and mow lawns so that we could get money to go skating or do something on the weekend. But, you know, it was... life changed after that. You know, my mom was there trying to make ends meet for three kids. And by then she was shopping in West Tampa instead of Ybor City, because we talked about how Ybor City kind of was on the decline. And she would go to a place called La Casa de la Palomilla, which was a butcher shop on, was it Armenia or Howard, Lorena? It's Armenia, I think. Not sure.
Yeah, though. I'm like looking at it, which one it goes west.
Yeah, I always get confused. I think it's Howard, but I'm not sure. But it was had a big giant plastic cow on the sign out front. So if you couldn't read Spanish, you could certainly understand it had something to do with cows. So anyway, that's what we did. And she would go in there and buy 5 pounds of good ground beef. And then she would come home and section it off. And one day we'd have picadillo. The next day we would have, I don't know, but the woman could take a pound of ground beef and cook it so different that as kids, we didn't even realize we were eating hamburger meat 5 days a week because you know, she came from Ybor City and she could cook, and it was all good food. So whatever was left of the picadillo, she would make stuffed potatoes a day or two later and use that as filling. It was great. You know, she, there was no money to go out to eat. So that woman came home every day after working so many hours. And I always say she was the queen of, she was the queen of 30-minute meals. She could, she would come home and she would put a pot of rice on or some pasta, and then she would decide what she was cooking, but she would have dinner on the table in 30 minutes. She was a hardworking woman, very smart. Never went to college, but was educated well at OLPH in Ybor City. And she was a wonderful writer, but she was just so busy taking care of three kids and trying to make ends meet that I don't think she ever got to enjoy any kind of hobby. All she did was take care of us. We knew that we were loved. We didn't have a dime to our name, but we knew that we were loved, and we knew that we could always call mom, you know, that she would take care of us. But gosh, we didn't have much. Everything we wore was hand-me-downs. Everything, every car she had was a beat-up car, some kind of hand-me-down from somewhere. And I remember 1 month, my mom had AAA, because we always had beat-up cars. And I think they came roadside about 3 times in a month, and they told her, they said, Miss Gonzalez, we're going to have to cancel your AAA if you continue to use our services too much. So we laughed about that. Now we laughed about it, but I'm sure my mom, as a woman being worried about being stranded on the side of the road, didn't think it was funny at the time. But I tell that story so many times, you know, what doesn't, in Spanish, we have a saying that says, what doesn't kill you will make you fat. And that is the truth. So
yeah,
we're all fat.
I've never heard it that way.
They say it in Spanish, but that's the essence of it. Mm-hmm.
And I was going to say, Janet, knowing, you know, you and how your mom was, I wouldn't be surprised if she was like, okay, I'm going to learn how to be my own mechanic and fix my car.
I'm surprised she didn't, because I saw her many times come out of the laundry room with a screwdriver, trying to get the last bit of everything out of that washer. For a while, we didn't even have a dryer, but it was crazy, you know. And it's so funny. My mother was so tolerant. It's like, okay, well, the washer's not working. We don't have money to buy a new one. So every Saturday morning, the first thing we did was go to the laundromat for probably a year and just do the laundry, pack it back, fold it, pack it in the car. You know, I don't think people realize how difficult it is to be poor. It's really hard. You know, it's really, really hard. You spend what could be your day off, where you'd be enjoying life or relaxing, getting work done. Like schlepping clothes, you know, 10, there were 4 of us, 10 loads of clothes to the laundromat, folding it all, bringing it home, putting it away, cleaning the house. It was not an easy life. But, you know, my mom, whether she was unhappy or not, we never knew it. You know, she was just mom to us. And I wish that her life would have been different. And there were often times that as she got older, you know, I tried to make up to her for all the things that she couldn't afford for herself in life. And the last year of her life, I'd go get her from the nursing home. I would stuff that wheelchair in the trunk of my car. Half the time it was hanging out of the back. And I would take her to the best restaurants for lunch that I could find for that last year. Every Sunday I was running for re-election, and I told my staff, I'm like, look, do whatever you want with me during the week and on Saturday, but Sunday belongs to my mom. I knew she was on her last year, so I had to be able to at least see her once a week and spend some time with her. We had a great year. It was really great. I mean, it reminded me of, if you ever read that book, Tuesdays with Maury, where we would sit and talk about different family members or memories that she had. But Gracie loved to eat. She loved good food. So that's when I would really see her light up, when we go have a nice lunch together. And then I'd take her home back to the nursing home. It was always hard to kind of leave her, because she did so much for me. I was 16 years old when my daughter was born. And my mother was so kind. She was a pretty devout Catholic, and I was so afraid at 16, of course. And she was so wonderful, you know, like sat down and said, well, what are we going to do? And, you know, faced with choices, it was 1974. It was the first time that you actually had a choice. And I still think, and I know we're not going to get political here, but I thought about all the women that fought for us to have that choice too. But, you know, that choice was between myself and my family and my boyfriend at the time, who was my husband after that for 20 years. He was 18, I was 16. And my God, you know, my belief. And so as hard as it was, we opted to get married and have that baby. And now 50 years later, that's Anna Cruz, my daughter, who is one of the most, what is the word for Anna? Not just complex, but one of the most amazing women you will ever know. You know, she had vitiligo as a child. So she was bullied a lot and she was heavy. If you see her today, you wouldn't know anything about that. Lorena remembers. But, you know, she is one remarkable, amazing young woman, middle-aged woman now, I guess. But she's incredible. And she was born when I was 16. We did a lot of growing up together and it was hard. And so I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought I wanted to become a doctor. I wanted to go to med school, although I didn't know anything about college, anything, because no one in my family had gone to college. But now I had a child to take care of and I came from a poor family. So my grades were good and I went to HCC and they said, we can give you a scholarship. And back then they had what they called the BEOG, Basic Equal Opportunity Grant. And I think back then it was about $900. We were on a quarter system then, $900 and tuition. So the $900 was to buy books and do other things, but I was able to go to college because of that. And speaking about clunkers, I remember that I would tell people, Lorena, I probably told you this before, but I would call my trip to HCC campus like a 1 gallon trip, because I had a Ford Fairlane and it had, we had like a tablecloth over the seats so that the springs wouldn't poke you in the butt. And in the back seat, I had a gallon jug of water. So I'd go to school, and when I got to the school, I would park on the street, and there was no parking then, and the car was overheated. So I would go to class, and the car cooled down by the time I was finished with a couple classes. I'd lift the hood, and I'd pour a gallon of water in and get home. And then I had an extra gallon of water in case for some reason I had to stop along the way. I'd have to do it all over again. And I think I did that for 6 months before we could afford to get the radiator repaired. That's just how poor we were. And people take a lot of things for granted. And I think this is important. I call it the silent struggle of the poor student. It's wonderful that you have help. They have Pell grants. We have all kinds of grants now that can help us get an education and help us climb ourselves out of generational poverty, which is what an education did for me. But there are those silent struggles that we don't talk about. Like someone would say, hey, we have an hour and a half between classes. You want to go get a sandwich? And I'd be like, no, I'm not really hungry. Well, I really didn't have the money. You know, I ate when I got home. Hey, we're going to do this. So this club is going to do this or this on Saturday. Can you volunteer or you want to come and join us? It'll be fun. No, I have a job and a daughter to take care of. Many of us can relate to all of that. And so when I finally graduated, it was a 2-year program. I went to HEC. I registered and enrolled, and I looked on the right hand column of all the programs they had. They had some wonderful programs then. They had nursing, nuclear med technology, something with radiology, program that I went into, which was opticianry. But I looked on the right hand column and I was like, okay, which one of these programs pays the most when I get out of school? And it was opticianry at the time. And that's where I went. And I went from there to working in an optical shop, and then Pearl Vision Center offered a franchise. And remember, this is that poor kid who has nothing. I finally was able to buy a reliable car once I became a licensed, once I sat for a state board and became a licensed optician. So life was better. I was actually on Section 8 housing, so I was able to get off Section 8 housing and pay my own rents. But then they decided they were going to start selling their stores. And I told my mom, I said, Mom, I think they're going to sell my store, maybe out of a job, but I'll find something else. And so they offered a program that was very attractive for the opticians that were working in the stores, but it was still like, I think 10% down. And through the grace of my mother, who in 30 years at that gypsum plant had collected stocks. So she went down to the bank with her stocks in hand and used that as collateral to get me a loan so that I could buy into the Pearl Vision franchise. And the rest was history. You know, that next day I went from signing the back of a paycheck to signing the front of a paycheck. I learned all about inventories. I got what I called an on-the-job MBA on finance and inventory controls and profit and loss. And it was all very exciting. And there was this great sense of pride and ownership. You know, I felt so accomplished in doing that and just worked really hard, bought a second store. My husband, who had never worked in the optical business at the time, I sent him to Sarasota. We bought an optical store there and he learned the business, but he was traveling an hour every day to do that. But it was, it's what you do. It's what you do if you want to change your life. And I tell people, when I sit on that Senate floor, I sat on that Senate floor and I thought, look at me. Look at this Ybor City kid here, the daughter of great grandparents who were immigrants who didn't speak English. You know, they could work in the cigar factories and really not learn English because they were surrounded by folks that spoke their native tongue. And they kind of grouped up on the cigar factories, you know, they'd sit together so they could speak in their native tongue. And so I always tell people, don't ever let anyone define you, because if they defined me scientifically and analytically, I should probably be I should probably be some lady on the streets of Ybor City, and my daughter should probably be in foster care, but we defied the odds. So I like talking to young women, especially about not letting anyone define who they are, you know. And I tell them, if you go home and the lights are out, and they'll go back on, you know. If you go home and the water's off, it'll get done, you know. Don't let any of that define you. And then I tell a lot of the young girls, stay away from boys. That's not love, you know. That is just not love. So focus on an education and focus on doing the hard stuff, not the fun stuff. But that's what I did. It was hard, but I did it, and my life is wonderful, and I'm quite thankful for where I am today.
So in between Pearl Vision, mm-hmm. You were in healthcare a bit after that?
Yeah. Yes, after I...
Why did you choose to switch? Because Pearl Vision sounded like, from your history,
it was wonderful.
A dream for you. What an amazing accomplishment to have your own stores.
We were in the mall, and the mall rents were astronomical, as they still are. And what happened at that time, that was in the 80s, I think. Yeah. The baby boomers were moving into an era called presbyopia, which is where they needed bifocals because they couldn't read. And that was a big wave of the population, the baby boomers. So these mega companies were creating these vision works and these eye labs and all these superstores that were not in the malls. They'd be out in what do they call them, in strip malls, or they'd be on these little buildings outside of the mall. But they would build these 5 and 10,000 square foot optical centers, and they were doing bifocals in a day. We didn't have that capability. We could do regular glasses in about an hour or so, but we couldn't do bifocals. So they came in just like any other big businesses and just swallowed us up. So we stayed as long as we could. We probably stayed too long. Like I said, it was my first experience with business, but it was pretty heartbreaking to watch it happen. For a long time, we did very well. So it was time to go. And I sold my franchise and went to work for Cigna. And I had a wonderful 10 years at Cigna. And then Aetna came and recruited me. And I went to Aetna. I was there about a year and loved it. And then they bought Prudential, and there was so much duplication of positions when they merged the two companies that I was a low man on the totem pole. And I'd been working political campaigns the whole time in my off time. I managed all of Bob Buckhorn's races until the last race. Because I was already elected, but I was his campaign manager for all the city council races and his first mayoral run. I did a lot of judges' races, and I was very, very happy being like the kingmaker. I liked that. You know, I liked working behind the scenes and meeting folks and helping others get elected. Did some judges, did Julie Holt, the public defender. And then this seat came up. And this seat was open because Mike Shanti was the sitting House member, and he was a soldier. And Obama, once elected, asked him to come to the Pentagon to do some work in the Pentagon. So he had to resign his position. And this was a what I call a special election. So it was only a 2-month election cycle. But more importantly, it was in my neighborhood. It was a West Tampa seat. And it was families that I'd grown up with and families that knew me through my activism. So it was very exciting and wonderful. So I was elected. I served I served about 8 months, and then that I was just serving the remainder of his. So then I had to go back. I was elected in, I think, February or March. Then I had to go back in November and run again and won again. And that time in November, Joe Redner from Mons Venus ran against me.
Wow. That must have been a colorful experience. You know,
I was just always very nice to him. And to this day, we're still very nice to each other. I just believe in this process is very nasty, nastier now than it's ever been. But I look at it like, you know, I understand that I'm a Democrat. I understand that you're a Republican. And I know there are some issues that we will never agree upon. But 90% of the time when we're sitting on the House floor voting, probably 97% of the time, we're all voting yes on a bill. Many, many bills are not, you know, something that makes the headlines, but it's those few bills that you see that we're fighting over. But, you know, I learned a lot about walking across the aisle and working to get the money that I needed for the Tampa Bay area. I brought $40 million back to HCC for their allied health building. That was very important to me because that, again, is a story that we talked about. And I want more students who are not set or who do not have the financial depth to go to a 4-year university to be able to go to HCC and take one of these technical programs and walk out. Right now, they're begging for nurses. HCC is one of the first programs to have a bachelor's program for nursing. And a nursing student can walk out of HCC and I think starting salary is at least $70,000. So it will change someone's life significantly. Mm-hmm. It really, really will. And that's part of what we need to take a look at. We need to say to our kids and our family members. Technical programs, trades are okay. Everyone doesn't have to struggle to go to a university. There's a program now that works through HEC, but it's a welding program. And a welder will walk out of that program after, I think it's a year, making close to $100,000 a year. It's amazing. It's amazing. Plumbers. And now in the healthcare, sonographers, you know, sonograms, and the chief of staff at Moffitt was telling me that they are poaching. I don't know if I'm supposed to say this or not, but I think it's wonderful. They go after some of the people that are working in the cafes, and the people that are working in the cafeterias, or maybe some of the people in the environmental services. And they say, look, if you'll go take this program, we'll cover it. And it's for like CT scans. There's such a shortage for CT scans, I think, from the neck to the chest. But you take someone who's making minimum wage and, you know, you pay for them to go to school and they can make $50 or $60 an hour. That changes someone's life. Yeah. And when you have support that your family can't offer you, like Moffitt saying, yeah, you know, we can help you get through this. And the worst thing we can do is steer students who are in financial dire straits like I was to any of these colleges that are, I call, predatory, where they charge a fortune. They talk these kids into all kinds of loans that they'll have a very hard time repaying. And, you know, that's been one of my causes for a long time, is to offer more in the school system. When I went to Robinson, they had auto mechanic, cosmetology, and one or two other programs there that you could walk out of high school ready to go. So we need more of that too, understanding that everyone cannot financially go to college, nor do they have, you know, maybe they have learning disability. Maybe they suffer with concentrating. There's so many different issues. So I am a strong proponent of these programs because I'm a byproduct of one of them. So here I am today, kind of retired, yep, but not really, you know, just working on a couple of causes. I'm very dedicated to clean water, healthy kids, making sure that the water fountains and the water sources in schools that have lead pipes are filtered. So that's my new, that's one of my new causes.
So what, if you looked back on your time in the Senate, and I know you have wonderful causes and you still are working very hard for our community. And before we started recording, Lorena, and you were talking about a few things that are going on. What is a few of the key topics that you felt that your work, along with, you know, other senators, succeeded in? What type of change, or what are you most proud of during that time?
That's a good question. And I passed a lot of really good bills, but one of the last bills that I passed, I thought was so significant. And that was a bill that spoke to injunctions for protections. And a lot of people would probably recognize that as a restraining order. And what a lot of folks don't understand is that once, I'm going to say a woman, but it could be a man, but once a woman files for an injunction for protection, that is the most dangerous time for her life. Or that is where, if any bodily harm is going to come of her, it is once that partner or husband finds out she's filed, the first 48 hours after makes her very vulnerable, because you have a very angry person who's been told that he can't get near her, perhaps the kids. And so until this injunction is served, he could go stand inside of her workplace and intimidate her and others. And there's nothing, they can call the police, but there's nothing they can do. He can stand outside of her job. He can sit outside of her house, and there's nothing they can do until he's been served with the injunction for protection. This is the most bizarre part of all of that, in the vein of we want to do everything that we can to make someone who feels threatened safe. They take the injunction, the judge signs it. Then it honestly, if he lives in a different district or a different area, they honestly fold it up and mail it to the judge or to that next county court, to the clerk of the court. Sometimes that adds a week before it's actually recorded. Could be almost 2 weeks before they find him or her and serve her with the injunction. So when I heard that, I was shocked. I was like, are you kidding me? Yeah. So my bill said that it is okay, believe it or not, in this day and age, unless you've lived under a rock for the last 20 something years, it's okay to send the injunction via email. You can still get a timestamp. You can still get a verification that it was delivered, but they're actually mailing via snail mail these injunctions and putting women and men at risk for an additional week or so. It was just senseless. So I truly believe with all my heart that we're going to save lives with that bill, that women will not be as terrorized as they have been in the past. So I'm very proud of that bill. And I worked closely with Spring and several others to help make that happen. And there was lots of resistance, believe it or not. Lots of these small counties didn't want to see change. And I said, too bad. We're doing this, whether you're ready for it or not. It's an email, for God's sake. Fix it.
Right, right. And it's protecting a human being from harm that feels threatened, right?
Yep.
So
that was my favorite bill.
Well, it was very important, and I'm sure it saved a lot of lives.
I believe it will going forward for a long time.
Yeah, up until this point. So you've spent all this time in, you know, private business, working for a company, in public service, you know, and you talked about education, and really the thing is providing opportunities for folks. Tell me about, you know, it's Women's History Month. Tell me about your thoughts on how important it is to mentor young women and even young men. It's Women's History Month, but, we're all about equality. How important mentoring someone and really actually being there for them is.
I can't stress the importance of mentoring a young man or a young woman through life and telling them your story and telling them not to give up. I mean, we take for granted what wonderful lives we're living in right now, but you know, there are families right now that are struggling. They're struggling so badly that if you have a young man or a young woman that their dream is to go to college, but they have a mom here who can't even buy food, and they feel a sense, you know, oftentimes with single moms, you'll find that the sons and the daughters become surrogate spouses. So there's a great deal of guilt about going away. Who's going to take care of mom? Who will do this, or who will help make sure that we have food on the table? Because right now, the job that I'm working pays for the food. So how can I go away, and how can I ensure that my little brothers or my little sisters are eating, or not being made fun of for having cheap shoes or broken, beat up clothes? This is the kind of stuff that we don't really want to talk about. And, you know, when I was in my 20s and 30s and maybe even my 40s, I didn't want to talk about being a teen mom. You know, I was on this track of mentors, and I wanted to be like a mentor. And I did not want to talk about how poor we were and how embarrassed I was for anyone to come over to my house because we had nothing. But now, as I'm older and more mature, I wear it like, a red badge of courage, and try to make a difference for other kids. So I think that when kids see us, when young men and women see us and they think, oh, look at her, she's got it all together, you know. Let me talk to you about how I really didn't have it all together, how it's all about a little true grit and pushing through all of this stuff and not quitting. It's so easy to quit when you're surrounded by people who don't see life the way you do, especially if you're not supported at home. You know, if mom is not going to encourage you to go to school because she wants you to continue contributing to the household. There's a lot there that people don't talk about, but I want these young men and women to know that it's okay to talk to someone about it. It's okay to talk to someone other than those that are at home and get some guidance. And a mentor is the best person to talk to. I mean, a mentor can take a young man or woman aside and say, look, I know you're worried about leaving home, and I know you feel like you still have to work. But in, you know, if you could just play the whole movie and see where you'll be once you're finished with college, play the whole movie, you know. Also, you know, take a stand for yourself and say, I need to do this for me. I need to break this cycle of poverty, or break this cycle of no education in my home, and be the first one to go to college. And you would be shocked at how many students are the first in their families to go to college right here in Tampa Bay. The numbers are amazing and astounding. So, you know, junior college is the answer too. You don't have to go to a four-year university. You stay right here and do a couple years and at HEC, which is wonderful. Or in St. Pete, and you know, work yourself over to USF if you need to stay close to home. But I really do believe that some sort of technical training, some sort of license, or some sort of degree is the difference. And the onus is on us to help these children who have parents that don't understand the importance of an SAT. They have no idea. My mom didn't know the importance of an SAT. She had no clue. She'd never been to college. It just wasn't something that I think today may be a little different, but it's very different for families that are just trying to make it through the day, you know, just paycheck to paycheck, issue, you know, one issue, one drama to the next drama. Somewhere along the line, it's our job as mentors to quiet all that noise so that a young man or a young woman can emerge victorious. And it's just, you know, the issues are twice, three times the issues of others. So I'm here for them.
I think it's really important too that, you know, elected officials are fighting for us and fighting for our rights. But then there's nonprofits like Feeding Tampa Bay and the partners that we work with that are helping connect, whether it be Fresh Force, which is our job training, or, you know, moving forward, we're going to partner with other institutions and organizations so folks can have that opportunity for stability. I'm really excited to get into that work. Lorena, what do you have to chime in on that for a moment?
Yeah, no, this is all very exciting. And so I have a few points to make too. It's, you know, Janet, you said it beautifully as far as, you know, bringing that next generation, those people that are, you know, right there hungry for what's next, right? Like providing that safe space, that quiet space to help them grow and to open their eyes to what the possibilities are. But I think, you know, to your point, a lot of times, and, you know, I can see this in my relationship with you, is even just opening the door for a conversation and then allowing a person just to see you and your actions and what you're doing, right? And setting that example. So sometimes it is like literally grabbing their hand and pulling them up and saying, you're coming along for this ride. I'm going to teach you, or I'm going to show you, and I'm going to open some doors for you or explain some things to you. But other times it's also leading by example. It's, you know, putting really where your what is it, your money where you're where, you know, like showing your actions, right? So watching someone from afar can also be a form of, you know, having a mentor relationship. Maybe it's not an everyday thing. Maybe you just talk to them from time to time, but being a person that really stands up isn't just, you know, saying these words, but actually is creating these actions. And, you know, to your point of, these trades and technical institutions. Absolutely. That is such an amazing pathway. And as you may know, we are so fortunate here at Feeding Tampa Bay to have programs that afford that. Someone can walk in and may not necessarily have a clear path for employment. And through the programs that we offer, whether it's, you know, they get their CDL license, right? And they can be a truck driver for us or any other multitude of corporate companies out there. Or maybe it's, you know, working in the warehouse and learning the logistics. And I think one of the great things that we do here at Feeding Tampa Bay too is that we do the soft skills training. That is one of the most important parts, right?
Absolutely.
It's not just giving you the skill, but it's also giving you the mechanics of how do you how do you react and interact in a conflict? So understanding, you know, the principles of conflict resolution, interpersonal relationships, right? Like if you're working in a warehouse, that's great that you know all the logistical methods, that you're trained, that you're certified in certain things. But if you can't actively go and speak with a colleague and have a conversation and be able to interact, then, you know, that training doesn't do much. So we're excited to have that as part of, you know, Feeding Tampa Bay. And as we grow, we look forward to enhancing those programs and having great partnerships with the HCCs of the world and, you know, other technical institutions. So we're very excited about that. And it's just, it's heartwarming to hear your story. You know, I've heard it before. I you know, talked to you so many times, but just to hear it again. And I'm sure for you, it's almost like you're reliving it, right? And like you said, you sit on that Senate floor and you're like, here I am. This is me.
It's so true. It's so true. And, you know, we as women, especially women that grew up poor or, you know, you always question yourself, that old imposter syndrome, they call it, you know, do I belong? But, you know, I was never a show horse in the House or the Senate. I was always a workhorse. It didn't matter. I didn't want credit. You know, there was no ego here for me. It was about doing better for the people who are struggling. You know, I wasn't struggling anymore, but I can't, you can never forget where you came from. You know, I think about my mom and kids like us and, you know, that's why Feeding Tampa Bay is so important. You know, do you know what it takes for a family to come and say, I need food? You know, it's just so wonderful. The food costs are through the roof now. Families are suffering. And you know how poor families suffer? They suffer with less nutritious food. They can't buy the expensive produce. They can't buy the healthy choices. They have to buy what goes the longest way. And, you know, without Feeding Tampa Bay, there would be lots of hungry kids in classrooms, unable to concentrate, lots of hungry moms. I'm just so thankful that you guys are here and that you've grown in such a large scale capacity. It's incredible to see where Feeding Tampa Bay is today. So I promise you, I'm going to get over there and volunteer some, Lorena. How about that?
I would love that. We'd love to have you here.
Okay.
We'd love that. We would love you to come see the new facility and the great things that are going to be happening due to that location.
Lorena told me about that. Make sure you put me on the list for whatever happens for the opening. I want to be there. That's coming up when? This year, right?
Yeah, this May. Year. So we should be opening our doors in May. So I know that we'll have a community day and I'll make sure that you have the information so you can come visit with us and, you know, take you around so we can see it all.
Good. Would love that. Would really love that. You guys keep doing what you're doing. You know, this is the Lord's work. I'm not an overly religious person, but when you break bread for people and give them bread to break, it is a holy thing, my friends.
Well, it's also a holy thing to help create change, to protect us and provide for us. And we thank you for your service. And
you're welcome.
Before we let you go, I would love to know if, you know, it's not an easy life to be a public official. There's a lot going on. There's probably so many things that I can attest that I don't understand and I have a lot to learn. But what do you have to say about encouraging folks to go into public office? What key things do you think you need to soul search for?
That I wish I had started younger. I was in my 50s when I was first elected, and I saw some of my colleagues maybe some in their 30s, but many in their 40s. But you become so effective after 4 or 5 years. And I was there 13 and I'm done. But if I had another 10 years ahead of me, I think that I could have been even more effective. Yes. So start early if you're thinking about this. The pay stinks in the House and the Senate. So that's part of the reason that a young person working on their career kind of hesitates, because the pay is $28,000 a year. It's supposed to be a citizen-led legislature, and it's supposed to be a part-time job, but it's anything but a part-time job. But, like Roost List is an organization that holds training sessions for curious folks about running for office. I think they do a good job about that. But my advice is to think about it sooner than later, because, honestly, the highlight of my work career was the time I served in the House and Senate. I loved every single day that I was there, both the good days and the bad days. And, there were lots, people think it's just so vitriolic and a lot of fighting, but no, there was lots of camaraderie and lots of laughter. And I miss it. I'm happy doing what I'm doing now, but it was certainly some of the best days of my life.
Well, and then that with that influence, you never will stop serving.
Right. That is correct. And I think it's wonderful.
Find your own goals.
Yeah. And Jen, I was going to say, I think it's wonderful that you said this, but it's so true that what gets, put in the media is, the controversial things that happen. But mm-hmm. when you are in that elected body, there are things that get done that are positive, and, you guys govern and, you make things happen. And then I just like to add, Janet, I think the words you were looking for when you were describing Anna, and I would say that this describes you and this describes Gracie, your mom, is maverick and forces to be reckoned with. You have, truly embraced those words. I have seen it. And she was modest earlier when she talked about, she wasn't there for the fanfare. That's probably correct. She wasn't there for the fanfare. But let me tell you, she was very well respected. She still is very well respected. And she truly was a force to be reckoned with when she was serving us at the state. But in a good way, right? Like, people respected, and she absolutely, reached across that aisle. And that's why, you are who you are. And I'm just so happy that you got to join us today and, kind of example of, for Women's History Month, of what it means to truly, pull yourself up and create the success that you want to see in your life.
Look, you don't really wish it on anyone. It wasn't easy. But, it's certainly doable. And that's why I try to tell these women that think, I can't do that. You can, you're the one that defines yourself. So yeah. It's been an honor and a pleasure to visit with you guys today.
Well, thank you so much. I'm so honored to meet you. There's so many folks, you talk about your journey. There's so many folks struggling now because of inflation and all types of things going on. So I think every word that you said can be taken to heart and encourage. Mm-hmm. We hope to see you very soon in person. We'll have to have you out for a tour to see that new facility. And I know Lorena is going to keep you up to date in our work.
Yeah. And if folks are listening today, there are so many ways. I just want to remind them. And, there are so many ways to help Feeding Tampa Bay. There are so many things that you can do. Just write a check or send a Venmo or help the good work that you're doing. The saddest thought to me is a family that's hungry. That breaks my heart. And, when you grow up a Latina, the first thing that happens when you walk in the door is, what do you want me to make you to eat? I mean, every sad event is around food. Every happy event is around food. Everyone sits around the kitchen table and we're talking about a decision in life. It's around food. So yep. do something for Feeding Tampa Bay, write a check, volunteer, make a commitment, help.
Help spread our word, share the podcast.
Indeed, indeed. That's
so thank you so much, Senator.
You're welcome.
You can learn more about Feeding Tampa Bay and how to join the movement at feedingtampabay.org. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and TikTok at Feeding Tampa Bay.